Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Admiral Robert Papp, Commandant of the United States Coast Guard. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Paul Hempstead. Admiral, as a maritime nation, the U.S. relies on the sea for prosperity, trade, transportation, and security. We are also an Arctic nation, with the Coast Guard leading the way. Would you tell us more about your efforts leading the nation's maritime engagement in the Arctic? What are some of the challenges you're facing in this area, and what are you doing to build the needed competencies and capabilities?
Michael, we've operated in the Arctic before, but it's been primarily icebreakers going up there and doing research. There's been almost an absence of human activity year-round in the Arctic. That's changing now. I spent the first 2 years of my career in Alaska. I can recall trying to get to Kotzebue, Alaska in July of 1976, and we couldn't make it through the ice. There was just too much ice. We couldn't get there. Fast forward 35 years later, in August of 2010, I went back and flew into Kotzebue for a visit, and from altitude, I could see no ice anywhere. So I'm just stating the obvious. The ice has receded, and with the ice receding, we're seeing a big increase in human activity, and any human activity on U.S. waters means there's a Coast Guard equity, whether it's search and rescue, environmental response, law enforcement, could be ice breaking. But we have all those responsibilities, those broad mandates that we carry out on U.S. waters. There's now more U.S. water to go out and serve. We've seen little things popping up here and there, like cruise ships coming into Barrow, Alaska. Fishermen going up there, recreational boaters who want to go up to the Arctic. But the big thing for us is this coming summer, presuming the permits are approved, Shell Oil will be up there drilling in two locations. They will introduce 33 ships, two mobile drilling platforms, and about 600 people. And they'll be transferring people by helicopter, rotating crews, which throws in the potential for rescues, so search and rescue. We know that there are environmental groups that will try to protest this, that may even try to obstruct the process. Law enforcement comes into play. We'll need to provide for the security of not only the protesters, but also the legitimate commerce that will go on. And then there's also the potential for environmental damage, which we have a responsibility for as well. So to take care of all these equities up there, we would, in most areas of our country, have shore-based infrastructure that we could operate from. We have none up there. So what we'll do for the next probably 5 years or so is we'll do like we've done throughout our history. We'll send a ship, and we're going to send one of our new national security cutters. It has a command center with worldwide command and control capabilities. We have hangars for two helicopters on the ship and can launch and recover them. And we've got three boats with boat crews that can be launched from the cutter as well, and it will supervise. It'll be like having a Coast Guard sector office up there, except it's going to be afloat. And then we'll send a couple of logistics ships, some of our seagoing buoy tenders that are ice capable, that'll be up there with the National Security Cutter as well, and probably forward deploy a couple more aircraft. But we've been actually experimenting for the last 4 years. We've been sending our equipment up there, seeing what functions, what the effect of the weather is on them, to have a good idea of what we'll need to execute the mission. Problem is, we haven't got any increase in resources, so any resources we send up there come off other programs that we would be doing, like longline fisheries in the Pacific, Bering Sea fisheries, drug interdiction in the Pacific. We'll have to take ships off that to send them up there. Long haul, we're going to have to come up with some plans on what we'll need for long-term shore infrastructure. And I don't think this is a cost that should be borne by the Coast Guard alone. Talking about strengthening partnerships, we've been talking to the Alaska National Guard. I've been talking to General Jacoby out at the Northern Command because that falls within his area of responsibility. And we're working with our partners to see what sort of facilities, whether it's communications, landing strips, hangars, other things that we're going to need up there. And then we'll put forth resource proposals, making sure that we're not being redundant to something that somebody else might be doing.
You know, given the significant fiscal and economic pressures the country is facing, DHS leadership has embarked on a department-wide cost-cutting effort. Would you tell us more about your efforts to cut costs and realize savings? What are some of the key initiatives being pursued to achieve cost reduction?
You know, part of my obligation coming in as Commandant was to control costs. I foresaw that we'd be facing these constrained budgets, and as my team came on, we started looking for areas that we could control. We've consolidated. We've worked with the department in terms of things like administrative support, computer technology support, other things that perhaps we can share across the department. We continue to look for those sorts of things. But there's things within the Coast Guard control as well. I talked a little bit earlier about transfers of our people. Every time we transfer a Coast Guard family, on average, it's about $25,000 to transfer a family, some more, some less, depending on how far we're sending them. On average, we were transferring people every 2 to 3 years. We've instituted now some 6-year transfer policies. We've looked for opportunities to keep people within geographic locations. As I said, just this year alone, we came up with about $20 million in savings, which we can reinvest in other things. We've looked at selling some of the properties that we own. We had a commandant's quarters in Washington, D.C. for about 40 years. I saw the opportunity. The Air Force was building some public-private venture housing over at Bowling Air Force Base. So we were able to come to an agreement with the Air Force, and a private venture built homes over there, mostly for Air Force generals, but they built 4 homes for the Coast Guard as well, at no cost to the Coast Guard. And to live there, I pay my housing allowance. To live there. So it cost nothing for the Coast Guard. We were able to sell the Commandant's House for $2 million and reinvest that in housing for our people. So every little bit helps. Every little bit that you can find, we're able to perhaps enhance other programs. So these are just sort of some of the things that we've been looking at.
So, Admiral, how do you keep your team focused in an era of fiscal austerity? What are some of the things you've been doing to make them mission-focused and not get so caught up in the changes that they may be experiencing?
Well, I think good communications. I get our entire senior leadership team together twice a year for alignment. So every admiral in the Coast Guard, every senior executive, and we bring in many times our master chief petty officers that are command master chiefs. They are sort of the interface between the officer corps and our enlisted workforce. And just like I talked about back in my days on the ship, I'd bring my officers together, my chief petty officers together, give them my vision, and then more importantly, listen to them and find out what their concerns are. And if I can't respond to them, then find a response or maybe change my mind on something. So that I think, is the start, getting the entire senior leadership aligned and with your philosophy. I've given them my direction. We came up with something called the Commandant's Direction, which enumerated everything that we're trying to do, and we gave it out to the entire service. Every year, I do something called the State of the Coast Guard speech, and this year we took it to, first time we took it outside of Washington, D.C., we took it out to San Francisco, to our base in Alameda, and did it right in front of those new ships that we're building. And then we fed it live to the entire Coast Guard. We found as we overwhelmed our system, not enough bandwidth, but we're able to put it back out there, and every person in the Coast Guard has had to either watch the tape or read the transcript. And I've validated this because when I travel, I ask and all the hands better go up. So it's constant reinforcing of the message and being consistent. What people like, I find, is as much as we talk about change, we like consistency in our lives. And what I try to do is outline my beliefs, outline our objectives, and then consistently press it out to people. But also be willing to listen to them and their concerns. And by golly, sometimes people convince me to change my mind on things, which is a challenge sometimes because I have a pretty clear vision about what we want to do in the Coast Guard. But social media, we've used social media extensively as well to try and people informed out there. So there's a lot of things, a lot of new tools leaders can use, and we've been trying to use them to the max.
You also mentioned before that the overall well-being of Coast Guard service members and their families is of paramount importance to you. Would you care to elaborate on the Coast Guard's efforts to foster a greater sense of community, strengthen a sense of belonging and value, and improve service members and their families' quality of life and resiliency?
I think in a certain respect, Paul, that's an easy task for us because people don't join unless they're motivated to serve. And I think the Coast Guard offers an attractive array of things, whether it's our humanitarian-type services, being one of the armed services, people who want to do law enforcement. There's something for almost anybody who wants to join the Coast Guard. We get a motivated bunch. As I talk to folks, I'm just amazed by their patriotism, their excitement, their dedication. So the challenge for us is more, how do you sustain it? How do you keep it going? And I think a lot of the things that I just talked about, aligning leaders, using the technology that we have for me to talk directly to every member of the Coast Guard, and then to follow it up. I've lost count now, but in the last year or so, I think I'm up to around 30,000 of our people I've spoken to directly at all hands meetings, everywhere I go. For instance, even though I was going down to speak to a couple dinners in Florida, we stopped at all our major units, and just in the course of a day and a half, I was face-to-face with probably close to 800 Coast Guard people. And I'll speak for 5 or 10 minutes, but then I use the balance of the time, and I ask. I say, I want your questions, comments, gripes, and opinions. Good chief petty officers can put all four of those into one, but it's the gripes and opinions that are really more important to me because I need to take those things back to Washington and then work harder for our folks. We've got a pretty resilient bunch to begin with. Sometimes they don't know what they deserve. For sometimes I go and I look at housing areas and they're deplorable in relationship to some of the stuff the Department of Defense is getting. And I want to do so much better for our people. And I think we're making progress, but there's still a long ways to go.
Admiral, with every major response that the Coast Guard has taken the lead on, there are important lessons to learning and capture. For instance, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. What lessons have you learned from that event, and how have they differed or complemented the lessons you've learned from, say, Katrina or the Haitian earthquake?
Well, I think the thing that's consistent across the board is pushing down responsibility for carrying out our missions to the lowest possible level. In the case of Katrina, we had people out there immediately. We didn't need to ask Washington if we could deploy the helicopters. We had air station commanding officers, a district commander. They knew what their responsibilities were. They started doing it. The earthquake in Haiti. Yes, the 7th District Commander pulled those ships off other missions, but those commanding officers on those ships started heading in the right direction to begin with as soon as they heard about the crisis. So we've got people who are authorized and encouraged to make decisions at the lowest possible level. The oil spill is the same way. The initial response, getting people out there, and a lot of good commanders taking on responsibility and taking action. The anomaly about the Gulf oil spill was we had never encountered something like that before. And the whole structure of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 was focused on Exxon Valdez, where you have no matter how large the spill is, it was a finite spill because you can figure out how much oil a tanker carries. You can figure out how much oil is going to be in a containment facility on a shore facility. And the requirement for response plans were predicated on the worst case scenario, and you could define the worst case scenario, we thought, until we had a blowout at 5,000 feet and we could not get it contained. So every day was a new worst case scenario. As a federal government, we had lost the bubble on the technology that was being used down there. And in fact, it presented even the industry with some new technology challenges in how do you cap a well that deep. So it was a big learning experience for us. And I think one of the other lessons that came from it for us is the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 forced all the response and funding the response equipment into industry to foot the bill. So the country had no oil skimmers, had no oil boom or anything else that we could call from a stockpile because we were requiring the operators to do that. And we couldn't force operators at other locations around the country to send the equipment because they had liabilities of their own that they were responsible for.
The complexity and diversity of the Coast Guard's mission sets require a range of analytical techniques and approaches to manage them effectively. Therefore, increasing the use of analytics and enhancing analytic capabilities of your office is probably critical. Would you elaborate on current efforts to strengthen these capabilities?
Well, one of the things we have, and it's not my initiative, it was something that was started probably, I think, 3 commandants ago with Admiral Loy, is we have something called the Evergreen Process. So every 4 years, we bring in a cross-section of the service leaders. We bring them into a conference facility here in Washington. We use a contractor to come up with various world scenarios, famine, feast, disease, economy, you name it. We come up with probably about 7 or 8 different world scenarios. We break up into teams, and we come up with how would the Coast Guard react to this particular world scenario. Then we come back together, and we cross-reference all the scenarios and see if there are any common threads, and we build that into our strategy for moving forward. And in fact, it played into my commandant's direction. We did the last evergreen process 1 year before I became commandant, and then we used some of those findings to inform the direction that we would take the service during my 4 years. During my 3rd year, we'll start the next evergreen process and continue to refresh ourselves. But it's also trying other things. I talked about doing more with less. I like to find ways of doing less with less, but being more effective. So we've looked at various risk-based scenarios. You can send a boat out there on a patrol on a daily basis, and what we find out is you might be more effective by sending it out less frequently, but on a more random basis, and still provide the same level of security. You're not wearing out the boat and the people as quickly. And, oh, by the way, you're probably more effective in terms of throwing off any terrorist planning or something like that. So we're working with think tanks. We have our own embedded staffs that are working on this. And it was one of our major efforts while I was the Atlantic Area Commander on our staff to start working these things. And now I'm just sort of sitting back and letting it run. And we've got a number of these projects going on that I think are paying dividends for us.
What does the future hold for the U.S. Coast Guard? We will ask its Commandant, Admiral Robert Papp, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.